With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hi, goalies. The episode you're about to listen to deals with racial violence in Atlanta 40 years ago. We would be remiss if we did not address the racial violence plaguing our country today. Last week, George Floyd, yet another innocent and unarmed black man, was murdered by a police officer in Minneapolis, Minnesota. George Floyd is, unfortunately, as we know, one of far too many black people killed by police, and his death, along with other recent slayings of innocent black men and women, has rightfully sparked national outrage. Book Squad Goals stands with the Black Lives Matter movement. Now is the time for action. We have included in our show notes links to organizations you can donate to, petitions you can sign, and officials you can call to demand justice and help fight against systemic racism in America. To our black listeners, we hear you. We see you. We support you. We stand with you. We will fight for you. Thank you for listening.
Puppies and kitties, books and movies. Yes, we love these. Listen to this podcast, please. Books by Goals.
Welcome to Book Squad Goals. I hope you weren't having too good of a day, because if you were, we might ruin it now.
Yeah, time to bring it down.
Sure. It's about to get dark. Dark Squad Goals. Okay.
we can't laugh. This episode's not funny.
I'm only laughing because I've had a White Claw and a half to cope. So the laughter is not about the subject matter. It's just because the world kind of sucks.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we were like, let's watch something really depressing and talk about it.
For sure.
The thing we're going to talk about is just one example of how the world sucks. It's a big one. Mm-hmm. But if you don't laugh or have a couple White Claws or, I don't know, take a lot of naps or do something.
Drink a lot of wine.
It's too much. It's too much.
Do a little dance. Make a little love.
Get down tonight.
Get down tonight.
Yes. But before you do all of that, you should watch Atlanta's Missing and Murdered, The Lost Children, which is what we're talking about today. After we talk about that, we're going to have an interview with Mary Kay McBrayer talking about her book, America's First Female Serial Killer, Jane Toppin and the Making of a Monster. So it's a lot of murder today. At least with Mary Kay, there's going to be some more happy talk than
happy
what
murder.
We're about to do. Yeah,
versus sad murder.
I take responsibility for this. This was my pick.
I mean, it seemed like the best option.
It's a very important documentary, yeah. I think, and it's very well done. So I don't want to sit here and say, like, I'm sorry we watched it. I'm glad we watched it. It was heavy.
I'm not sorry I watched it. I'm just sorry if it brings you down. Although it should bring you down because, like, it.
That's kind of the
you
point.
You need to know about it.
I'm sorry that it exists because I'm sorry that this happened.
Yeah, I'm sorry that this had to happen in the first place for us to even talk about it. Okay, that said, content warning, murder, harm to children, racial violence. I don't know if that even covers it, but stuff along those lines.
Yeah.
And also, we're going to spoil it. Yeah. But these are real events that happen, so
If you don't already know about them, then it's not really our fault that we spoiled it. All right. This is a true crime docuseries on HBO. And so the intro question is, what's your favorite true crime documentary or docuseries? Let's talk about some other dark crimes, too, that it's not all this one.
I'm ready.
I didn't think about this ahead of time. Go ahead, Mary.
It's Mommy, Dead, and Dearest.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
Oh, man, that is a good one.
And I also love the TV show that's based on it, The Act.
Mm-hmm.
It's just such an insane case that no matter, like, even watching the fictionalized version, I was thinking, I don't know that this is quite as insane as the real life version. I mean, it's just, like, such a wild case.
Yeah.
Also, it's Tickled. Really.
Oh, yeah, that was
What
weird.
Is Tickled?
Tickled is about...
I've heard of that.
An underground tickling ring.
There's a homophobic underground tickling ring.
A homophobic underground tickling ring.
It's just an interesting twist that you're
someone,
not expecting.
And they don't know who, and the documentary filmmaker is going to get to the bottom of it. Someone is commissioning young men to video themselves tickling other young men while
no homo, though.
Wrestling
no
singlets.
Homo.
But it's not a gay
this
thing,
this is an episode of The Dollop that I've heard, but I did not know this documentary existed.
I think it's on Hulu
it's
right now if you want to watch it.
A plot line that was stolen for season 4 of Riverdale.
Of course it was.
Wow.
Oh,
I'm not
wow.
proud of it, but I was very pleased.
You were like, wait a second, I know this
You were
story.
Like, I was I into tickling rings before it was cool, so.
I 100%. Emily, did you watch it?
Yeah,
we
watched it.
I feel
it.
Like we rented
yeah,
it.
Yeah, we did. I was very, like, on board to watch it, like, as soon as it was available. And I think I texted you, like, hey, it's out. Let's watch it.
You should now listen to the episode of The Dollop about it. Okay. It's one of their earlier ones. And then I'll watch it.
Okay, cool. I'm making
we'll talk.
It's on Hulu. We can reconvene.
Because listening to one of them learn the story as the other one is telling it is great.
It's wild. Yeah, it's
there's so a lot of like, wait, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Anyone else?
You know, it's a tough one for me because I watch a lot of those. And so every time I think of one that I want to pick, I think of like another one that I'm also like... But that one's really good, too. I think one of the ones that, and now I can't think of the name of the documentary because I keep thinking about the name of the book. So, Susan, you can help me out. The book is Bad Blood. What is the name of the documentary?
The Inventor.
Yes, The Inventor. I wasn't that big of a fan of the book, and I don't know if that's because I saw the documentary first. But I found it fascinating, and maybe it's fascinating for the length of, like, one documentary movie and not, like, a full book. But if you want to read more about that, let's plug Susan's blog right here. There you go.
Where I talk about every piece of media that covers Elizabeth Holmes.
I just love a good scam. I find her really interesting. I'm very fascinated by the way that she makes her voice really deep. And I've, like, watched several YouTube videos, like, comparing, like, her normal voice versus her deep voice. Yeah, it's just crazy. The Firefest documentaries were a close second in my brain. But I couldn't decide which one because I kind of, like, watched them back to back, mm-hmm. So they kind of
merged together.
You can read a blog that Mary and I wrote about that to compare them if you need to.
We'll put all the links in the show notes to this stuff.
Just plug all the blogs I've ever written.
This is just
they're all about crimes.
Plugging our blog this whole podcast. So there you go. That's me. That's Emily.
This is Kelly. I am not the biggest true crime person. So I haven't watched a lot of things. I do tend to lean towards more, like, scammy things and enjoy that a little bit more. Just because, like, for me, especially serial killers, I tend to find, like, boring. But it's just, to me, it's like, okay, like, they killed another, like, it's, I don't know. Like, the whole, like, what's it called? The book that we read.
I'll Be Gone in the Dark.
Yeah. That was, like, super boring to me. Like, the Golden State Killer could not be more boring. Just because, I don't know, like, I don't get what is interesting about serial killers. However, so, like, and so much of true crime stuff seems to be centered around serial killers, and I just kind of, like, don't, I'm not drawn to it. But something that I did enjoy was the Amanda Knox documentary that came out a couple years ago.
Yeah, that was a good one.
It was good. It was on Netflix. Because they had, you know, they had, like, a lot of interviews, like, with her. And it was just, like, it was well made. And I find that case pretty interesting.
And terrifying.
And terrifying, for sure. And just weird. Just really weird. So, yeah. I thought that was good. I mean, I liked Making a Murderer, too.
I could not. Mm-mm.
It got to be too much.
I could not with animal abuse. As soon as that came up in the first episode, I was like, nope, just fry him. I don't care.
I don't even remember that happening because it was like, I guess it happened in the first episode, but it wasn't really brought up again.
Yeah,
I was more interested, not in like the main guy who got accused, but of his, I guess it was his nephew. It's been such a long time since I watched that, but this like young kid who obviously was just like taken advantage of and completely manipulated by the legal system. So
he just wanted to watch his wrestling shows.
Yeah. Poor kid. He's out now though, so
yeah. So I don't know. I'm not an expert on true crime at all. So I'm kind of like, I defer to y'all.
Okay. Hey, this is Susan. I do enjoy serial killer stuff more than Kelly does. I thought I'll Be Gone in the Dark was really interesting.
That's fine. I feel like I also love the weird scams, though, so
it's not all killers that I love. and I don't love the killers themselves, to be clear.
You're one of those people who has, like, a Ted Bundy poster up on your wall.
Oh, my God. Yeah. No, I'm not. And don't make people think that.
No, I'm just too
I tend to like stories that really dig into the case and the trial surrounding the crime. And so I am going to bring up an older documentary. Okay, there's a dog underneath me. Good Lord.
But what dog?
It is... It's Riz. Hi. I couldn't tell you it was.
You're like, who is it?
But this is also on HBO. I'm not sure if it was originally an HBO film, but it's the Paradise Lost documentaries about the West Memphis Three.
Mm.
They are long and exhaustive, but I like stuff like that really goes like way into a story. So those.
Yeah. Can I do a third place one?
Yeah.
The O.J. Simpson documentary that came out recently was really good as well, kind of for that same reason, because that trial, speaking of interesting trials, like...
Buck Wild.
That trial was, like, primetime television, whatever. But, yeah, so...
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, speaking of miscarriages of justice, like in the West Memphis 3... let's talk about Atlanta's Missing and Murdered, the Lost Children. This is kind of a long summary, but I want to read the whole thing because we can't, like, summarize this whole case very well.
This decades long. I think this
at least covers it. So, Atlanta's Missing and Murdered, the Lost Children is a 5-part documentary series offering an unprecedented look at the abduction and murder of at least 30 African-American children and young adults in Atlanta between 1979 and 1981. 40 years later, with the official reopening of the case by Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms, the series tells the inside story of this shocking tragedy, shedding new light on the horrific killings through exclusive archival material as well as interviews with those closest to the children and the investigation. The series tracks the story from the initial disappearance and discovery of two murdered teenage boys to the fear that progressively gripped the city, ultimately building to the indictment and prosecution of 23-year-old Wayne Williams, who was found guilty of murdering two adults while also being linked to the murders of 10 children. Days after Williams was sentenced to two life terms, most of the children's cases were closed and attributed to Williams without ever going to trial. Further, it details the rush to officially shut down the case and the continuing deluge of questions that remain unanswered, including how the victim's family members, along with many others in the Atlanta community, remain skeptical of Williams' guilt. The documentary series also points to alternate suspects and details the biases and unexplored leads that may have tainted the original investigation. So, first of all, just how familiar were all of you with this case prior to watching this? And if you weren't that familiar, why didn't you know about it? Because I actually learned a lot from this.
So I knew of it, and I knew that, I forgot which podcast did a season about this.
I think the guy that did Up and Vanished.
Yeah.
Is the one that.
So.
And Atlanta Monster.
Yeah. I know Tyari Jones also wrote a book about it. And so. And I started listening to it, but I was being too ambitious. I got too many books to read right now. I didn't get to finish it yet. But it was one of those things where I was like, I know that there's stuff out there about it, and I'm interested, especially because I've spent a lot of time in Atlanta. I lived in Atlanta. But it was just one of those things where it's like, you gotta kind of have to be in the right mood to talk about child murders or read about child murders. And so it just hadn't come up yet. So even though I was aware of the case and I was aware that there was stuff out there about it, I hadn't, like, hadn't read any of it yet or listened to any of it yet.
I honestly, so, like, I, Emily and I both grew up in Georgia, and I never heard about it, like, growing up.
Yeah, same.
Never heard anybody.
I mean, this happened before we were born, but still.
It did.
It did, but also, it's so many people.
Yes.
So, like, you'd think.
Yeah.
But I did, so, like, I don't know. I don't remember when it came out, but, like, last year, this year, whenever. What are years now? What's time? when the second season of Mindhunter came out. It deals pretty heavily with this case, and especially the FBI's involvement in this case. And after watching Mindhunter, I did do a little Wikipedia reading. Like, oh my gosh, like 30 kids went missing and I never heard of this in my state?
Yeah, you would think that that would be something that you would hear about if you were a child and this had happened to a bunch of children. Yeah. Like, I don't know, however long before you.
Well, and I wonder, too, like, because they were all, you know, African-American children, if, like, yeah. white kids just didn't get told about it because, like, white yeah. parents weren't worried about it, you know?
Exactly.
White kids, and especially in, like, I grew up in a really rural place that's probably, like, 2.5 hours from Atlanta. So, like, people still have that mentality of, like, that's not us.
Yeah.
Atlanta's like a different place. Mm-hmm. But in after reading about the case and watching Mindhunter, I was really interested in this documentary series. And I was also really not shocked, because Mindhunter is obviously fictional and based on real events. But, like, I just kept thinking, ooh, they did this case dirt in Mindhunter. Like, they made the FBI look really cool.
Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah, people who work for the FBI wrote some of that show, so.
Yeah.
Gross. I had never heard of this at all, like, at all. And as I just said, like, I'm not a true crime person, so, like, I really only know, like, the most, like, famous cases, but that being said, you would think that this would be one of the most famous cases, considering... Yeah. The pure, like, quantity of victims. It's crazy that I've never heard of this. And, like, it makes me mad. Much like a lot of this show made me mad. Not, like, at the show, but at the, like, events and the way that they unfold. It's just, like, fucking ridiculous that something this monumental could happen. And, like, it, I feel like it's one of those things that basically just gets, like, erased by history. And part of it, too, I think, is that, like, when we talk about true crime, like, people like to focus on, like, the serial killers and, like, all the, like, the, like, young white women who get killed by, like, you know, mm-hmm. and that kind of stuff. And I think that there's something extra depressing about children being killed where, like, it loses that sort of, like, even though, like, obviously no crime should have, like, that sensational element. But, like, that is a factor, I think, in what makes certain cases, like Ted Bundy, for example, so popular.
Yeah.
Is that, like, I don't know. It's less fun to talk about or to theorize about or whatever when it's, like, little kids. But then also the, like, element of race, which is, like, a huge reason why it's not talked about.
That's what I was going to say. I think, like, most, if you look at the cases that get a lot of attention, most of them are white people.
White victims, yeah.
I think there is a little bit of that, like, and this isn't right, but I think especially looking at crimes that happen in cities, there's, to some extent, there's this sort of public belief that, like, oh, well, it's inner city crime. Black people just die.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And again,
it must be gang,
like,
related.
Don't like chop that out and quote me on that, because, like, I don't believe that. But I think, like, that's just kind of the way that a lot of people, especially, like, people who don't live in cities and who don't really, like, know anything about being around other people. who live, like, really sheltered lives, that's kind of how they look at cities. Like, especially cities like Atlanta kind of have a reputation for things like that. And, like, I'm saying that as somebody who lived there for a really long time, so I don't like that.
And I think that people often associate, like, crimes like this with, like lower income populations, which means they must be doing illegal things and selling mm-hmm. drugs and blah blah blah, like, multiple
or,
times,
like, what were the parents doing?
Yeah, like there's, like, a whole section of this about one of the victims whose parent was a prostitute, and, like, this whole thing where, like, she must have killed him or like, she didn't give a shit about him anyway, so it was her fault that he got, and it's just mm-hmm. like so upsetting. And, like, I mean, I think it's also, I think maybe you guys said this while I was, while my internet was out, but important to acknowledge that we are all white women and,
No, we didn't say it yet.
Okay. Yeah. Well, important to acknowledge.
we should just have this.
We have to give this disclaimer
every episode.
Often.
We're all white. We're very sorry. There's nothing we can do about it now.
Yeah. We hate ourselves, but, no, I mean,
we have the appropriate amount of white guilt right now.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and it's hard to talk about stuff like this, you know, like, as a white person, part of me, most of me is like, I shouldn't have an opinion and I should shut the fuck up. But here we are, we're talking about this. So, yeah, just so you know, we have no idea what we're talking about and we're white.
I mean, there's no way for us to, like, understand the experience of growing up black in America, but I think that that's mm-hmm. one reason why this documentary is so important. I mean, I think for me, this, like, really humanizes the victims of these crimes in a way that makes them feel important to me, even though I had no prior knowledge of this case. Even though I come from a different background, mm-hmm. everyone can sort of mentally understand that losing someone you care about is tragic.
Yeah. I think that, and I can't remember who said it. You know, we met a lot of people, and especially in that mm-hmm. first episode, I wasn't really, like, keeping track of everybody. So I apologize for not knowing who to credit this statement to. But there's something that someone said in the first episode that I thought was really poignant and kind of, I don't know. And again, like, I don't want to say that every Black person experiences the same thing. I don't even want to say that every Black person in Atlanta experiences the same thing, or every inner city Black person. But what he said essentially was that, you know, a lot of Black people live with this constant anxiety of being stolen or right. being taken away mm-hmm. because they come from a lineage of people who were stolen. And I thought that was a really interesting way to phrase it and explain it in a way that people who don't have that experience can sort of like understand and maybe not identify with, but at least see like, oh, I can see how terrible that would be to have that anxiety day in and day out. And I think that that's very, it seems just looking at the news on any given day, just looking at how, I mean, back in Georgia, just like last month, two white guys finally got arrested a month later after just like randomly killing a Black man who was running in a neighborhood. I think you can see that anxiety sort of being like reaffirmed, unfortunately, all the time. And I swear this stuff isn't just happening in Georgia, but those are the examples that keep coming up.
There are other states with racists.
Yeah. But I don't know. I found that, like, that statement really stuck with me because, like, again, like, as a white woman, I was like, I never really thought about how...
that kind of inherited trauma.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think inherited trauma is a good way to say it. So I thought that was really interesting.
Well, that's why it's so ridiculous when, like, white people sometimes say stuff like, oh, well, slavery was so long ago. And it's like,
yeah.
A,
first of all,
no,
it wasn't that long ago.
No, it wasn't. Relative to what? Okay, so. Yeah.
To dinosaurs? Like,
our country hasn't been around that long.
Exactly. But there are so many clear problems and, like, really deep-seated beliefs and behaviors that are easily traceable to what Black people went through during slavery that happens like this. We don't think of stuff like stolen people because we didn't experience that. But Emily, I remember that too, and I was like, oh my God. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. That is a really poignant way to say that.
And I really wish that I could remember who said that because I feel like it was a really good point.
One thing that's really weird about how much I haven't heard about this case is, like, it's unclear, first of all, if all these murders are attributed to one person, but several of them have to be the same person. So there is at least a serial killer by definition here. But, like, you hear about serial killer cases, even ones with tons of victims, like Green River Killer or something. And it's like, even when you hear stuff like that, if you consume any true crime media, you can know something about who those victims were because you've heard it enough. Mm-hmm. Like, I had never seen a photo of any of those children before.
Yeah.
And every single time one of them came up, I was like, oh my God, he's so little.
They were all like, so cute. Oh, just like
they were so little, and I kept looking at them and thinking about how, you know, like, these murders happened like 40 years ago.
Yeah.
So I kept looking at them and thinking, like, what would that person look like as an adult now? You know.
Mm-hmm. And you can almost see it because a lot of them look exactly like their moms, who are who are like the most badass people on the planet, but we'll talk about them later. I have a question about them, mostly just because I want to talk about how much I love Camille.
Oh my God. I love her.
But, like, I think it says a lot about just like how this whole thing was kind of like swept aside that I had never even like seen a picture of any of them. The only reason I'd even ever seen Wayne Williams' face, the guy who may or may not have killed two people, is because it's on the cover of the Atlanta Monster podcast. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the image. I didn't know that was who that was until this documentary started, though, either. So, like, I didn't even know anything about the accused person, which is, I mean, we're just going to roll right into the next question, which is about race. But there was a moment where they talked about, like, well, pinning it on Wayne Williams, pinning the rest of the murders on Wayne Williams, stopped the racial discussion from happening. Because if it was a white person that had been doing this, then a race war could have started. Mm-hmm. But if they say, oh, it's just a black guy killing black people, then we'll just sweep it under the rug, which is what happened. So, and I'm like, well, that's why I've never heard of Wayne Williams either. Yeah. Because they just were like, this guy is almost a sacrifice of the case.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not he killed the two adult people, like, it seems kind of wild to pin the rest of the murders on him and then just be like, that's it.
Yeah, it's absolutely insane. Especially, like, the further along you get and the more, like, the more the evidence that was presented against him is sort of, like, diluted because it's like, oh, these fibers. Oh, but wait, like, actually the records that they had of where these fibers were incorrect. And like, each piece of the case that they used to pin against him just, like, slowly starts to fall apart. And it's like, yes, it's possible that he did these, like, at least the two. But it's also, like, any of these other people had just as much evidence against them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As him.
Yeah. That's when, like, the extent of the racial motivation behind sweeping it under the rug, like, really came out. I mean, it was obvious from the beginning that there wasn't enough attention paid to it because of racial and socioeconomic factors, but, like, the way that he was prosecuted was, like, oh my god, like, we're just gonna let that happen? Okay. Like,
right.
And, like, the moms who have been fighting for just someone to pay attention this entire time are like, yeah, we don't think he did that. So,
yeah.
We're just gonna keep
It's pretty shocking when you see the, like, 40 years later footage when everyone meets up to kind of talk about, like, reopening this case and everything, and someone asks at the front of the room, like, how many people here, like, are 100% mm-hmm. certain that Wayne Williams killed these people, and literally one person raises his hand.
One white dude.
Wasn't he involved in the investigation?
Yes.
Probably. He probably has to say, like, yeah, I believe it. Like, I'm responsible for putting
the other white dude who was with him didn't even raise his hand. Yeah. He was like, alone.
Yeah. And, like, maybe, like, 10 people said that maybe, like, 20 people raised their hand for, like, I don't know if he was involved. And then a lot of people raised their hand for, like, I do not believe that he was involved. So, yeah.
Queen Camille was like, over and over, like, the media would be like, so do you think he killed your son? She's like, I don't think he killed anybody.
Yeah.
Like, but
yeah,
stop asking me this.
Yeah.
It's like, so again, we are just rolling into the next question because we cannot talk about any of this without talking about race. But the profiling stuff was really interesting to me too. And Mary, I don't know how much any of that tied into, like, what they did in Mindhunter, because I know that's a lot about profiling. But it was, like, basically they just ruled out white people.
Yeah.
Like, oh, well, it would be noticeable if a white person came in here and killed somebody, so we've just decided the victim, or the suspect is black.
Yeah.
Which is wild to me.
In Mindhunter, sort of, like, the main guy, the Jonathan Groff character, who's, like, a genius profiler and sort of invented...
Jonathan Groff's in that show? Yeah. I didn't even know.
And sort of invented profiling. He was, like, a white man couldn't have done this. It had to be a black man. And he had reasons for doing it, but even when he said that, I was like, But it seems like the easiest answer is racist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of shady KKK stuff going on, and you've basically got KKK members saying they did this.
Mm-hmm.
Admitting it.
Yeah.
And you're gonna say, but a white man couldn't have done it?
And, like, it seems like their main, like, reasoning is only black people are in these neighborhoods, and there's never white people around. But then it's like, but what about, like, the white cops that are around? And what about, like, the white, like, you know, people who work in different service industries who are around? People, yeah, like, repairing houses or whatever. What about, I mean, I don't know. There are, like, a million different reasons. Oh, and then one person points out, like, you know, like, white people knew that, like, they could come here to buy drugs because, yeah, like, that's where you go to, like, lower-income communities if you want to buy drugs, because that's what, like, people are being forced to do to make a livelihood. So, mm-hmm, like, there are a huge number of reasons why a white person might have been around, and you can't just say, like, well, white people don't come here, so.
Yeah.
But if you're an old white guy that people trust for some reason, you can say that.
Right.
I love that he was just like, well, we didn't say that it couldn't have been a white person, but we didn't look at any white people because it had to be a black person. Like,
yeah. Like, you could
but
hear,
you did just say that.
Like, yeah, what? You could, like, tell that the person, like, the filmmaker was asking the question, like, are you sure that that's not what you mean? Like,
and he essentially said, we didn't do that, but we did do that. So yeah, we didn't do, yeah, that. But we did. Do you know what I mean?
But, right.
Yeah, like,
but we,
yeah,
did.
No, we
but
got we it. You definitely did do that, but okay.
Yeah.
It just, it seems like the police wanted it to be a black man to make the outcome less culturally divisive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
And as soon as they had a person, they were like, this is our person. It will be him. Yeah.
And, you know, just from, like, the evidence provided, I'm not going to say I don't think Wayne Williams was up to something.
Yeah.
I don't know if that something was killing people.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they just had to find, they found one black guy who was already part of the community that this was happening in, mm-hmm, that people thought was sort of weird.
Yeah. Well, they thought he
was gay.
Which
it turns out is because they think he's gay, or he, yeah, is gay, but they are apparently scared of gay people.
The
so,
like, the first thing they say when they're, like, talking about why he's guilty, they're like, we know for a fact he's a homosexual. And I was like, yeah, how is that proof of literally anything? Like,
yeah, well, it's definitely not proof of murder.
Yeah, like, and that is also another thing that was really, like, unfortunate in all of this, was, like, the repeated way in which, like, being, like, gay automatically equates, mm-hmm, to, like, liking little boys, which is, yep, not a thing. Like, obviously that exists. There are.
It's not a thing, but it's a stereotype people have hung on to this day.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, I still see that kind of commentary. It's like, it blows my mind because those are, mm-hmm, completely separate things. And yet, I think that is why Wayne Williams specifically is the person that this was pinned on.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it was, like, easy to target him for that. And he also, like, had involvement with a couple kids in the community because he was, like, whatever weird, like, record-producing thing he was doing.
That's what, yeah, seems shady to me.
Yeah. I'm not saying he's,
like,
not
maybe
shady,
he was
but
some kind of scam with that.
I mean, yeah, he also, I feel like he could just be trying to get rich, but
yeah, I mean,
I was gonna, yeah, maybe he belongs on one of those scam true crime, yeah, things we were talking about. Yeah.
I feel like they could have picked, there could be several adult people in this community who would have known more than one of the almost 30 people that were killed, because the community is small and because, mm-hmm, you know a lot of them. Like, there were so many people who were interviewed just talking about, like, yeah, I went to school with that person or this person, and, like, I knew of him. Like, they just had to pick one weird guy who had some connection to more than one of them. And that's what, I feel like that's what happened. Mm-hmm. I'm not convinced by carpet fiber that he did anything.
Yeah.
Well, especially not after we find out that the entire, like, office in which they were, like, doing the
analyzing
samples was, like, literally raining fibers down from the ceiling onto all of the evidence.
Oh my god, I didn't even write a question about that, and yet that out loud I was just like, what?
Literally, like, the fibers were their only evidence, and then it was like, oh, by the way, Like, this is literally all completely irrelevant because... And then they tried to cover it up.
I need a whole documentary about that lab.
Seriously.
The fiber guy was like, everything was completely above board.
It's like...
We did sure about
that whistleblower. The whistleblower guy, like, more power to him. He was just like, hey, boss, this isn't cool. And he was like, I just kept going to my boss. And then I went to the next guy and the next guy. Yeah. And they said, like, you will commit perjury before you embarrass the FBI. And he's just like, no, fuck that. I'm just going to go public.
Yeah.
I was like, yes, son. Okay. What's crazy about that, though, and why I need another documentary is because it basically found that it was like 98% of the cases that were like... had tests of something done in that lab were fucked up.
Yeah.
What? That's a lot of cases. I need to know about those also.
Over, like, a period of time, too. So.
Yeah. I was like, this could affect thousands of outcomes of trials. And I was like, are we going to revisit? I need HBO to come back. Circle back.
We're not going to revisit it. Because, I mean, stuff like this just makes me completely doubt the entire justice system.
Right, which I already did, so.
I already did a little bit, but this doesn't make it better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of that fiber evidence, the other thing that made it suspect is the fact that the KKK guy also had that carpet.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were like, no one has this carpet.
Oh, what KKK guy? Do you mean the KKK guy who admitted to wanting to kill black children?
And that's the interview with him was wild because they'd ask him a question like, were you involved in these murders? And he'd like have his cigarette and just sit there for like 25 minutes in complete silence smoking a cigarette. And it's like, are you going to answer the question? Like,
well, and he also said, are we rolling? Are we on camera? Like,
right.
Like, as if the camera was off and he would say something different.
Right. Fucked up.
I like that. I'm not really actually going through my questions for real, but I am just coming around to the things that they're about, which is these KKK guys.
Genius. Yes. It's not the KKK guys. Your questions are genius.
Yes. Well, they just flow so well that it's just the natural progression of our conversation.
It should just say one question. Let's chat about this.
Yeah.
Ladies, what you think?
What did you think of the show?
Okay, so there's these KKK guys. Shocking, the KKK was pretty active in Georgia in the 70s. And these guys, it's three of them, right? They're brothers.
Mm-hmm.
This is like who they were kind of focused on looking at, although I feel like we could probably look at several of their associates as well. But there's these brothers. One of whom, like, just really openly talked about wanting to kill black children and also said that he did kill at least one of these specific children that was killed.
By name.
Told someone this and
apparently
that
in
person,
like a casual shooting the shit conversation.
Yes. Yeah, so the person he told was a confidential informant.
Which I love.
Yeah.
That guy is awesome.
My other favorite thing about that is that guy, like, said what the KKK guy said, and then the KKK guy is like, no, he said that to me. I didn't say that. It was him.
Not me.
It's like, I believe the guy that's not in the KKK, though. So,
also, that guy was great because he would say, like, I can't repeat what he said. There's women present.
Yeah.
It's like, sir, there's ladies here. And they're like, no, just say it.
Just like it's offensive to everybody, not just women.
Yeah. The thing you're about to say is way worse for all black people than it is for women.
There are
generally.
Also black people present, so.
I know. Oh, my gosh. Man. I love that, like, how much of that guy looked like a, like, motorcycle riding total hard ass. And he was just, like, a gentle dude. And I thought that was sweet. But, good for him for coming forward, but part of what he was uncovering was not just that evidence that this guy had said all these things and obviously hated black people based on, you know, the fact that he's way high up in the KKK and everything he says and does every day, but that this was actually investigated, like, undercover and then...
By the GBI.
by the GBI, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, and then it was just like, never mind.
They just dropped it because they were like, oh, we have Wayne Williams, so we're good. We don't
need
this.
They dropped it. They destroyed the evidence.
Yeah.
And nothing happened to them for doing any of that, which is, I guess I shouldn't be surprised based on everything else. But, like, that is wild that there's, like, proof that they destroyed it. And it was just like, okay, case closed. Like, no, it's fine.
And, like, when they were talking to one of the guys who, like, was involved in destroying the evidence, they were like, did you go through all of the evidence? He's like, there was a lot of it. Like, not really. I'm not sure if I saw all of it. And then they're like, okay, but you destroyed it all. And he's like, yeah, well, like, there wasn't anything pertaining to the Atlanta child murders in it. And they're like, well, how do you know that if you didn't see all of it? And he's like, I just do.
And they're like, oh, okay, you're white, so I guess that's fine.
I wouldn't be able to do anything related to court because the whole time I was just like, that guy's got a real tone. He's got a real tone, and I think he's lying.
Yeah.
I had a little bit of hope for a second, even though, like, this all happened in the past, and I could have just looked up the fact that it wasn't fixed, but... like, when they brought in these, like, really high-powered, like, civil rights lawyers and defense lawyers and just, like, I was really hopeful that they were going to, like, do something big because they seemed so prepared. And they did have the evidence. I mean, from what I saw of that trial, I feel like they won the case. But
yeah, right?
That's not how it happened. But, yeah, I just – in the end, I don't even know, like, what my theory is on this whole thing. Like, I highly doubt one single person did all of it, but I wouldn't be surprised if whoever the people are that did it aren't all connected through the KKK.
Yeah.
Right.
Really don't feel like it was the person who's still in jail and will be forever.
It's also...
yeah.
Wild to me that the KKK was like, there's going to be a race war. Let's kill some black kids and, like, see if it happens.
Like,
you can't do that. It's like saying, this guy's going to get mad at me. Just wait and see. And then you, like, kick him in the balls.
Right.
And say, see, he's mad at me now.
Yeah, let's see if we can provoke a race war and then blame it on the people who we provoked.
I think one of the things that, I mean, this is probably pretty obvious, but just to, like, point it out from the KKK, let's take a look at the KKK's perspective here for a minute.
Yeah, won't someone speak for them? Come on, Emily, what do you got?
But, I mean, let's talk about Atlanta a little bit.
Yeah.
Because a lot of how this story has to be framed is, like, what was going on in Atlanta at the time, what the narrative was in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And I know that you've kind of got this in your questions a little bit, so maybe we're circling
the question
that,
we never answered. I never asked it.
One of the things, and I mean, this is still the narrative in Atlanta, is that Atlanta is a great place for black people to live and be successful. And there's a lot of upward mobility for black people. It's, I think, and again, like, I don't have the numbers on this, but I'm pretty sure, like, Atlanta has the highest percentage of wealthy African Americans in the country. And so, I think from the KKK's perspective, the race war had already begun because, like, the idea of black people being successful and, you know, having good jobs and living in nice neighborhoods and just generally, like, making something of themselves and, like, you know,
having anything.
Deigning to be just, I'm using air quotes here, just as good as white people is inciting a war. So, yeah. I think, and again, not saying they're right, this is fucked up as hell. I'm just saying, I think that there's a certain group of white people who take offense to people of other colors being successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is
basically
still
true
to the success
today.
Of anyone other than themselves.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because to them, that means taking something away from them.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. What's that? It's like when like, when you have all of the privilege, equality feels like oppression to you.
Right.
Well, if you're an asshole anyway, like, I mean, this obviously still happens today, not just with Black people. I think, like, one of the clearest examples of it right now is, like, with immigrants. Mm-hmm. And the narrative of, like, well, these are our jobs that we worked for, so they shouldn't be able to work for them no matter how they do it. Mm-hmm. And, like, yeah, I mean, that's, I don't endorse that, again. but it's that same, like, us versus them, and you're taking it from me.
Yeah.
Well, and look at the way that certain white groups of people react to the Black Lives Matter movement.
Yeah.
It's that same mentality that Emily was just talking about.
The assumption that the statement Black Lives Matter automatically means white lives don't matter.
Yeah.
Which is not the point at all.
Like, the only people who think that way are white people.
Yeah.
White people, like...
Specific white people.
Yeah. But I'm okay with just saying white people in general as a white person.
I am too, but I'm also just keeping up with our continuous line of disclaimers that I don't mean me.
Yes. Yes.
There. We'll just have a disclaimer in the episode, like, just ignore us!
Yeah, just don't listen. Just don't
Everything
listen
we just said was...
White people are terrible. We are white. We might be terrible, but not because of this particular reason.
Yeah, but no, I'm on board with that. White people are terrible.
Yeah. Well, to go back to talking about Atlanta, and so part of your question in here, Susan, mentions Maynard Jackson, the mayor. And I thought that whole... part of the story was really interesting, that this mayor is a Black mayor and is like pretty like well respected, and seems to be, he's very, you know, pro Atlanta, pro like Black mobility and everything. But then as soon as this starts happening, he like tries to sort of engage with it while also trying to sweep it under the rug a little bit, because it definitely affects the view of Atlanta as this like positive, like, haven for Black people when Black people are being targeted in this way. And I just thought that the history of all of that was really interesting, and the idea that like this positive thing could also be spun into like another way to like abuse and oppress, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it reminded me also of, and like I've thought about this like right after I said what my favorite docuseries was, but I totally forgot to mention O.J. Made in America, which...
That's what I just said earlier.
Oh,
that was my third place.
It was probably when my thing cut out.
I think it was.
Yeah.
I shouted that out.
Okay.
Yes, that's a very good documentary.
Because that's what I should have said, because I actually... Yeah. I really, really enjoyed that. And,
But me being an idiot just said that O.J. Simpson documentary.
You know the one.
You know the one.
Yeah,
yes.
The ESPN.
That's exactly what I said. You know.
Yeah, which, like, the only time I've ever, like, watched and enjoyed something from ESPN, as a person who doesn't care about sports. But it reminded me of that in, like, just the way that this documentary was made, and that, like, it presents, like, a really interesting historical context for what is going on. And sort of like shows us all of that like right at the top, so that we understand like the impact of like the environment of Atlanta and all of that like on this case. And it also reminded me of how like there's kind of like a reverse situation happening in OJ Made in America, where it's like they decided to like stack the jury with Black people who they knew would be more sympathetic to OJ, because OJ was like, you know, he sort of became this like poster boy in a way for like a Black man who was like falsely accused. And they like spun this like support for him into a way to get him off of something that he like actually did. So it's like, it's like a lose-lose situation, basically.
Well, and that came out of the cultural context of L.A. at the time, too, and, like, the race riots. Then, yeah, I really appreciated all of that context, too, because even though, like, I I live semi near Atlanta, and relative to like the rest of the country, I guess, like 2 hours from Atlanta. But like, I didn't know any of that history, and it does help to like set the stage for every single thing that went really, really wrong with it. And that's one thing that I really like about the documentary I said earlier, the Paradise Lost one with the West Memphis Three, like, it gives you this picture of West Memphis where you're like, these people were doomed. Like, the kids that got pinned for this were doomed because they were like the specific type of outsider that at the time, the cultural context of that city just like was going to eat alive. And mm-hmm. yeah, I thought that was a really interesting part also.
Yeah. Which just like, I think that, We haven't talked that much about like the documentary itself and like how it functions as like a documentary.
Go for it though.
Well, I just want to say that I think it's really good. Like, you know, I mean, like, I'm not I've watched like documentaries, but it's definitely not my main thing that I watch. So I'm like not an expert at all, but I think especially like having recently watched another docuseries, which is completely like not the same thing, but like Tiger King is so badly made, so badly made. And like watching this was just like a reminder of like how to tell a story and like to make something like compelling without making it sensational, to be respectful of like the victims, but also makes like an interesting narrative, and just like presenting stuff in a timeline that makes sense. Like, I was never confused about what was happening when. I was never like, wait, who's that, what? Like, to me it all was like pretty seamless as far as like just a form of storytelling. And again, like, it presented the historical context. There was a lot of like really cool footage of like old Atlanta, like, even before, you know, the 80s when this was taking place, like, when they were talking about the, like, all the Black-owned businesses, and, like, mm-hmm. and there were also, like, so many beautiful photographs throughout, and, like, just, like, devastating photographs from, like, the trials and of all these mothers. Scene. Yeah, and, I mean, the crime scene photos are, like, just, like, appalling.
Really hard.
Yeah, like...
It's jarring, and I think it's important for people to sort of, like, see the victims and see the reality of what happened, but it is also really hard to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they did, speaking of docuseries specifically, one of the challenges of a docuseries is you're not just framing... hour and a half, 2 hour documentary, you're kind of making 5, 6, however many mini documentaries about the same topic. Mm-hmm. And so each one is connected, but each one kind of has to, take the subject matter in a new direction. I think this series did a good job of doing that. And to Mary's point about how hard all of the stuff about the murders is to see and to hear about, I think it was smart of them to really hit that hard in the first episode, mm-hmm. so that we didn't have to go over it in such detail in other episodes. Because I think if I had to watch 5 episodes that were just
bleak as the first one.
Yes, as bleak as the first one, it would have been really hard. And I think we need to see that to understand the importance of what's happening in the other... I don't know if importance is the right word, but you know what I mean. Of what's happening in the rest of the show. And I'm not saying the rest of the show isn't bleak, because it definitely is. And even like as I was watching the final episode earlier today, I was crying.
Yeah.
And Ben was trying to talk to me about some other shit, and I was like, can you not see? I'm having an emotional moment here. Like, I need you to not ask me about if you can make a phone call right now or whatever the fuck he was trying to say to me. But anyway, my point is, like, I've never tried to do something like that. I think nonfiction storytelling in general is just really hard because, like, you have to deal with reality and, like, making that into a narrative. And so, like, doing something like this seems like a very difficult, complicated task. And I think, like, the storytelling in this, just to agree with you guys, was really great.
And especially when you don't have, like, a conclusion necessarily. Yes. So you're working towards something and you work towards...
But I think one of the things... one of the things they said in the final episode that I think was really poignant, again, is, like, what is a conclusion for something like this?
Yeah. Because like, those kids are still dead.
There can't be a conclusion. You see a bunch of the family members say, like, I can't have closure on this. Yeah. There is no closure on this.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, like, there's more that should and can be done, but... Yeah.
I mean, like, as far as, like, a satisfying ending to a documentary or to any, like, true crime cases, like, finding out who did it, like, you know? And you don't know here, but, like, you don't... it doesn't leave you feeling like... I don't know. It leaves you feeling like maybe there's a chance that more might be done, like, soon, because it wasn't, like, as they're making this documentary, the current mayor of Atlanta is, like, working on, like, reexamining and, like, reopening.
Also, I was like, we've got a woman mayor, we got a woman police chief. What up, Atlanta?
There are so many,
like, I love Atlanta, y'all.
Amazing, like, women in this documentary, from, like, we mentioned earlier, Camille Bell, to the defense attorney, what's her
name? Mary Welcome.
The cutest name ever.
Yes, I know.
But she was so, I loved her.
I need a whole documentary about Camille Bell.
Yeah.
She was a character in Mindhunter as well, who I loved.
I like that she has 8 different pairs of octagonal glasses.
Yes.
And all of them are statements. And, like, every time she comes somewhere, she came to make a statement.
Yeah. She's just, like, no bullshit. She's, like, not taking it.
Oh, and, like, they're the media, like, when it showed interviews with her, like, the media constantly tried to undercut her and her cause and what she was saying. And she would just be like, they're like, oh, what's your coalition called? Like, the Murdered Kids Club? And she's like, no, that's not correct. Here's what it's called, and here's what it's about, and here's why. And, like, fuck you. Like, I love this woman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, do we want to rate this?
How can you rate it?
Yeah. That's why I said, do we even want to?
I mean, I'll say it's an excellently made documentary.
Yeah.
It feels bad to rate.
Yeah, I was just gonna, like, I have zero complaints about the way that it's made. Like, it's excellent. And I think, like, it is valuable to watch, even though it is hard to watch. I would recommend it, especially for people who are interested in this sort of thing, like procedural, like, crime documentaries. Definitely.
For sure.
It's definitely not for everyone. I think the subject matter is really difficult. But I think it's an important documentary that needed to be made, especially, you know, talking about raising awareness on a case that they're still working on.
Especially, like, if Wayne Williams is innocent, like, this man is in jail. Yeah. Like, he's in prison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And will be forever. Unless,
I mean,
you know.
Mary Welcome had a good point, sort of towards the end of the documentary. She said, even if Wayne Williams was to get out of jail now, what kind of life would he have? Like, he's grown up in jail. He's lived most of his life in jail. What would his life be like? But doesn't he deserve a chance to see?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. And there are so many, like, innocent black men in jail.
Mm-hmm.
So... to end on that positive note.
The positive note is that hopefully this continues to bring so much attention to it that it outrages a whole new group of people enough that more actual action happens on it.
Yes.
Especially because, like, I mean, some these mothers of the victims and families are still out there fighting for this, and they are not young. This was 40 years ago. It's like, let's, we need to get a whole new, like, generation of people so pissed off that it hasn't been fixed yet that something happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Get pissed, everyone.
Get pissed.
I am pissed.
We're just changing topic, sort of, to another killer story. Friend of the pod, Mary Kay McBrayer, has a book that just came out, surf debut book.
Yay!
And it's about crime, so.
Surprise!
Mary Kay's book is called America's First Female Serial Killer, Jane Toppin and the Making of a Monster. And I got to talk to her about everything about this book, just like why she is interested in this particular very interesting woman, how she went about researching it, the writing process. We just had a good chat. So,
yay! Yay! Let's hear it.
Enjoy. All right. Hello. We are here, or I am here, with Mary Kay McBrayer, author of America's First Female Serial Killer, Jane Toppin, and the Making of a Monster.
Yay! Welcome, I'm Mary so Kay. Excited to be here. Thank you for having me, Susan, and Emily, and Kelly, and Mary, but mostly Susan.
Yeah, I'm the lucky one for this.
Me too!
This
is very exciting. We are the chosen ones.
Well, listeners might recognize Mary Kay's lovely voice or her name from being on the podcast before or from listening to her podcast, Everything Trying to Kill You. But now, Mary Kay has also written a book.
I'm doing all the things. I can do it. I can have it all. Things. I feel like I say that the most when I'm like dropping everything at the same time. I can do it.
I feel that. I feel that. Well, this book is right up my alley, so I'm really excited to talk to you about it. So first, I just wanted to ask you about, clearly based on the title, this is a true crime book. Mm-hmm. What is your connection to true crime? Let's just talk about that.
Okay, so that's a good question, and I get asked that a lot by people who are just not into being scared. And I think for me, part of it is that I have anxiety, and so putting that in a controlled space, even though it's true, like, lets me have some semblance of control, right? Like, if I, and also, like, if I see all of this terrible shit happening, hopefully I can avoid it, you know? So I think that's a big connection for me. And then also, whenever I'm reading or watching TV, and there's nothing like at stake, I just kind of find my mind wandering and like shooting holes in the plot. Like, I'm the worst person to watch a romantic comedy with, because I'm just like, she could have gotten murdered at so many different points. Like, my head automatically goes there because I'm just thinking like that anyway. And then I realized, like, once I realized true crime was a genre, I was like, oh, I love this shit. I just didn't know that it was its own thing. Like, one of my favorite books in my nonfiction class that in college was In Cold Blood. So yes, I was like, oh, of course one. I like it. I just didn't know it. You know, like, sometimes you don't realize something that you know inherently until someone says it. And then you're like, yes, oh, yeah, that's exactly right. So I think that's my connection to it, like, emotionally. Is that what you're asking for?
Yeah, okay, yeah, definitely. Like, just like how, yeah, you're interested in it in general. And then how you made the switch from just being interested in it to wanting to participate in the making of this book. Like, this is, it's so cool. Like, I read so much true crime, so it seems like a dream to just be able to sit down and like research that stuff and like be the person behind it. And yeah, so
Yeah. So that's a great question. I love telling stories, and I can tell myself, like, when I'm really listening to a story, it's because I want to tell it to someone else. And I can tell, like, the story changes a little bit every time I tell it, because I'm like, oh, I just, you know, I'm workshopping this character arc or whatever. I don't really do it consciously until I do, but I remember listening to her version, or not her version, but her story on My Favorite Murder, and hearing, like, the very beginning of it and thinking, you guys aren't doing this right. Like, there's more to it than this. I mean, and of course, My Favorite Murder is, like, mostly comedy. They tell you straight up, like, don't rely on us for facts. So I didn't. And I went to go, I went to, like, read the book that was written about her. And I found one. It's called Fatal by Harold Schechter. But it's still, like, all of the facts, right? It's like reading a newspaper in the form of a book. And that, and it's amazing, and that takes a really special person, I think, to have the patience to really, like, sift through every single little thing to make it into, like, a chronology. But it still wasn't what I wanted to read, if that makes sense. Like, I was learning a lot, but I was also like, but there's no cause and effect. Like, I get that that's not what you're supposed to do as a journalist or as a researcher, but that's what I wanted to read, was, like, this happened, so then this happened. And that's also not the way that life works. So I think novelizing a true story really helps us, like, make meaning of what actually happened, which I need personally, like, for my sanity. So I read that book, and then I was like, you know what? I'm going to do this man. He's great. A favor, and redo it for, like, a different audience. I mean, that's really vain of me to say, but I was thinking, like, the whole time I was reading this, reading his book, this is amazing, but it's not what I want to read. So I just kept researching about it. And then I think I started with writing the first chapter, actually, which is set from the perspective of the people at the orphanage to which she was surrendered as a small child. And I think I actually did write the first chapter first, and then I wrote the last chapter, and then I wrote, like, the most interesting part to me in the middle. And then I was like, okay, now I have my arc, right? Like, some things are going to change, but that's how I did it. And then for me as well, I mean, and this is such an, like, a millennial thing to say, because we're the information era where when you have a question, it's like, I don't have to guess. I can go look it up. And then after 25 minutes of not being able to find it on Google, it's like, okay, I'm going to make it up. Like, I did my due diligence. I'm just going to decide on the thing that I think is most likely. So the researching never really stopped until it was, like, out of my hands to the publisher. I also typically have a kind of tricky time letting things go as far as revising, but when someone else had it and they were like, these are clean pages, it's like, oh, it's really validating, actually, because I think, weren't you in a writing program as well, where they'll find something no matter what?
Oh yeah.
Because you're kind of trained, like, it can always be improved, and that's totally true, but it's like, but are we just changing it for the sake of you having a suggestion, or, like, so that was cool too. I think your original question was, like, how did you go from hearing the story to writing the story? So I think it was a really gradual transition of, like, especially because there was so much research involved. And part of it too was like, and this is probably really, like, a fun story, but there's no Jane Toppin tour in Boston. Like, I had never heard of her before it was on that podcast. Her somewhat contemporary to her is the Lizzie Borden story, which has been done to death. So there is a Lizzie Borden tour. And I went on that tour. I went on the Salem Witch tour and everything, just because, I mean, if y'all can't hear it from my voice, I'm from the South. I'm not from Boston. So I had a lot to learn. And it was really interesting, because they would take you into the houses, and it just the architecture alone, like it was just not how I pictured it because I'm from the South. So we have like big rooms and, you know, a front porch. And that's not always the case there, especially because they had an apartment in the attic. And if you had one of those in the South, like you would just suffocate. Like you.
Oh, yeah.
It's so hot. It's so hot, like on the bottom floor. Like you want to get, remember like in school when they were like, if you smell smoke, get to the bottom because heat rises. Like. Right. I remember laying on the floor when I was a kid just because it felt cooler down there. So it was just a lot of learning in that regard and like taking notes as I was doing it and imagining walking upstairs and there, you know, and I went in the summer too. So if it had been cold, it would have been super cold. And I can remember being like, God, it's so dry here. And it's just things like I wouldn't have noticed if I hadn't gone there. So like even some of the journaling stuff was helpful because it was like a first person account. Was it her account? It was mine, but still I feel like, you know, she would notice if her hands were like so chapped, they were, you know, cracking and stuff. Right. So I really just did as much research as I could before I started writing. And then once I was like, there's already a narrative and I keep telling it, I just put pen to paper and then went back into the research when I felt like I needed to.
That sounds so fun.
It was
and
fun.
So, so challenging too. Like, I mean, especially because like you talk about this in the introduction, there's just not as much information about her as there are about people like Lizzie Borden or, you know, any male serial killer of any time.
Right.
Totally. For example. And you said also, you have that quote, about, was it Toni Morrison, the writing about what, writing the book that you want to read? That's so great.
I like to pretend that she told me that in a text, like, but that's not true. I just, you know, it's one of those things that she gets quoted on a lot. So, but it felt like she was texting it to me.
Exactly. I mean, I can see, I can hear that that is like so much of your motivation, especially after reading the Schechter book. And Schechter is like such a classic true crime writer, but you're right.
For real.
It is very dry and just, you know, it's the straight facts. They use it all the time. They use them a lot on last podcast on the left, which is a really well-researched podcast. And they always are like, so one of the sources is Harold Schechter. And it's just like a long list of facts. Well, that brings me to the question about why Jane Toppin? Besides, you know, that you wanted to read more about her person, like what is it about Jane specifically that made you want to know that? Want to know everything about her and to tell her story in a way it hadn't been told.
Yeah, I love that question because we are, I think, as a culture, somewhat in a phase of being fascinated with all criminals. Her story stood out to me, first of all, because I had never heard it and I felt like that was weird and like a very weird sort of cover up thing to do. And because I'm a naturally inquisitive person, if something is fishy to me, I'll be like, but what else? Like, it's really funny too. Like, and I do this with people whenever they're clearly like avoiding talking about something, I'll ask questions all around it until they cave. And that's kind of how, I felt about this story because it, or about her, because, for one, I think, and this is of course me just speculating, but she killed so many people. She admitted to about 30, 31.
Yeah.
And there's probably more than that. And she says in her confession, which I think is somewhat editorialized, but she says in her confession, like, I mean, there's probably a few more, but I don't really remember. Like, so I think that that's weird that it wasn't really talked about at, like, she was not really talked about very much at all. Partly because I think that was embarrassing to the like law enforcement at the time. Where they were like, oh, you killed 31 people. I know that. We know. Like, that's how I imagine them, kind of feeling about it. Cause, and for one, so she was a woman, which, I mean, when you think about it, you don't really, maybe Eileen Wuornos, maybe Lucrezia Borgia, but there are not very many women serial killers, not serial killers. Like there are women killers, but
yes, we've all seen
it's very uncommon, especially when they don't really know their victims, which right. is also interesting. So that was something that drew me to her. And another reason why I think she wasn't very much in the news, even at the time, was that President McKinley was assassinated right before she was arrested. So that was taking over a lot of headlines. Another reason that I really wanted to use Jane Toppin's story is because she had a very troubled home life as well, or formative years, I guess I should say, because like I mentioned, she was, well, maybe I didn't mention this part. So she was the child of Irish immigrants, and her mother died of tuberculosis when she was very young, which is tragic. And then her father, who apparently had a history of mental illness, included but not limited to alcoholism and violence because of that, surrendered her to an orphanage where she lived for a couple years and got only the education that was quote unquote necessary for a girl of her class. And then they indentured her out when she was, I believe, 8 years old, to a family who had another little girl who did not have to do any work. So I just feel like those series of cascading failures, we shouldn't ignore that. Like, yes, she was definitely a monster. I'm not saying that she wasn't, but I think it's, I think that it, is an important story to tell because, you know, that might not have happened if we had done right by her, you know?
Yes, yeah.
So I think that's why her, like, that's what drew me to her because, I said this in the author's note, which I'm not sure that you got, and I know the listeners probably have not read, but, I worked for, or excuse me, I served for a little while in a mental health facility for, they called them at-risk or emotionally disturbed kids. And it was really, I couldn't hang because it was really tragic to see that they were not really in control of what happened to them because they were kids, but they were being treated like adults and they had never been taught to be adults. And they just had zero advantages at all. And I think that paying attention to that can prevent a lot of tragedy later. And I don't mean that like every child who has had a hard life is going to become a serial murderer or anything like that, because there are plenty who don't. But I just, you know, why run that risk? Why not pay a little bit more attention and hopefully prevent any kind of hardship for anyone ever at all? That's the goal. That's a modest goal of mine.
There are so many crime stories that I hear about serial killers, like on podcasts and stuff, where when you, like, what you always hear just like out and about or people talking about are, you know, the number of victims or something, some crazy details about the crimes. Mm-hmm. But then when you hear these backstories, it's like, oh my gosh, like she never had a chance at a normal life. Or you can like kind of trace back and see why right. some of these
any
things
one of those
happened.
Things would have made me nuts.
And Jane's life did not get any easier after being in the Toppin home.
Right. And I really I liked her, you know, because she, I mean, I don't like what she did, right. but I mean, she was a genius, right? Like everybody liked being around her. She was really friendly. She was not afraid of hard work. She went to nursing school when she was 28, which is intimidating now. Right. Like in the Victorian time, it's like you want to start a new career in your midlife. Yeah. Like, okay. Right? I mean, do you know they didn't, I mean, speaking of like washing your hands, they thought that was bad. Like you were washing off good stuff. It was, man, when I was researching it, girl. they sold strychnine over the counter, like chocolate covered strychnine.
Oh my gosh.
I know. They were just like, they were really swinging and missing when it came to medicine back then. Like,
yeah. That's not like the place you want trial and error to be, the main form of finding right. out things, but clearly it was. Also, a note about strychnine.
I have never seen it written out before reading this. So, like, I was like, that's how you spell that? I had no clue. I'm like, it's like, I hardly ever come across a new word anymore. So it's just like a really exciting moment where I was like,
yeah, and the thing is, like, I normally know how to spell things, but not how to say them. So when I was narrating the book aloud, I was like, hang on, I have to look up how to pronounce this word. And the technician was like, you don't know how – you use this word in your book. You don't know how to say it. And I was like, oh, I know what it means. I obviously can use it in a sentence.
I know not to eat it.
Especially – right.
Chocolate or otherwise.
Especially, like, some of the – some of the towns, too, are like – I mean, like I said, like, I'm Southern. We might have that same town here and not say it the same way. So I had to, like, look up how to say the names of the towns, like, Katomit. That's not how I would say that.
No, me neither.
At all. Like, I mean, that's how they say it there.
I'm glad you said it out loud before I said anything about it, too. I want to listen to it again once that is available to me. Because this was so fun to read. And I can imagine, like, inhabiting those character voices while listening to, like, or hearing you inhabit the character voices as the narrator would be really cool, too.
It was really fun and really tricky when I had to do the male characters, because, you know, I have the voice of the country mouse in A Christmas Special. So the guy was, he was, like, coaching me on how to do it, and he was like, you don't have to do the accents. Just make sure it's clear that someone else is talking. So, like, go a little bit lower or a little bit faster or a little bit slower. When he was coaching me, he picked, like, the most difficult scene, which is when they're all at the bar, and it's, like, a bunch of men and Jane.
Oh, my gosh.
And
I was like, that must have been so hard.
I don't know how to do this. Well, I'm so glad he picked that one, because he was like, just mark by their names, like, a little bit faster, a little bit slower, a little bit louder, or whatever. And it really helped, or like a little bit drunker, you know, because it was really helpful because there are so many characters in that one spot. And this is a book that's mostly women characters, which is good for me because I have a really feminine voice. But that one scene, I think he picked just because he knew that I was going to have trouble with it. So
I'm glad that we're talking about characters, because my next question is about inhabiting all of these different character voices, because, like we've said, this is not, you know, like, straightforward true crime. This is, you've written characters in here, and while they're real people, like, you've had to come up with their voices and their actions and all of that. So how did you accomplish that? Like, how did you pull that off?
Well, that's a really fun, interesting question. Let me think about that. The one thing that I had trouble with was writing, I mean, not the one thing, but like the thing I had the most trouble with was writing from Jane's perspective, because, first of all, you know, when you write a character, you kind of have to, I don't want to say inhabit them, but kind of inhabit them. Like, you have to think like they think, anticipate like what they would hear, what they would notice in a room. Yeah. And I didn't really want to go in her head that much. Like, I mean, I wanted to know about her, but I didn't want to be her because she got really scary. Like,
yeah,
a bunch of people.
It escalates.
So that was the hardest part to do. And as I was thinking about, like, transitioning from researching to writing, I also didn't feel like it was super authentic to tell too much of it from her perspective, because we don't know what she thought. Like, right. Even in her confession, it's clearly like no one would confess that way. Like, not even on TV. It just doesn't look realistic at all when she's like, well, you know, if I had gotten married, I probably wouldn't have had the chance to do all of this stuff. It's like, that is some propaganda. Like, this is not how it would have gone, from based on what I know of her. So I, like you were saying, I wrote it from a revolving perspective. So anytime I could get a first-person account, those are just more interesting to me as a reader. Yes. So I tried to do that. And then one of my other cautions to myself was, be very respectful of the victims. Don't portray them negatively. Be fair, be kind. And so I, for a lot of that, especially for Amelia Finney, who is the one testimony they had from a victim that didn't die, that was an interesting chapter to write because I didn't do it in the first person for that reason. Like, I didn't want to tell her story for her. Like, she did it on the record and it's really protected. But I did think that that was one of the, I think that was the middle scene that I was talking about, the one with her when it's like, oh shit, hit the fan here. Yeah. the most interesting scene. And I tried to consider the time period a lot too, because it was Victorian, like before the turn of the century. And decorum then, as it has been for a long time, was very particular. Like, we're talking about, this is why we have the names light and dark meat for chicken, because they couldn't say breast and thigh aloud. Like, those, that's why we have table skirts, is because they thought the legs of the table were too sexy. So I think, like, trying to tell some of those stories it is a salacious narrative, but doing it in a sort of roundabout way without euphemisms was kind of tricky. And I also tried to picture, like, who they would be telling the story to. Like, if they would be telling it to a sister, they'd tell it differently than if they were telling it to, like, a detective, right, or something like that. So that's one thing that I noticed. And then I also, and this is maybe another answer to why Jane, she would have been one of the house workers. So she would have noticed if she came in and, like, the curtains were different or there was dust on the table. Whereas some of the other characters might not have. Right. So setting was a huge part of figuring out the characters, because, like, I even have, I think I have Elizabeth ask Jane, like, so if he wanted to, like, see about you, that's how I say it, like, oh, I'm seeing about him, meaning, like, I'm considering dating him if he wanted to, like, see about you. So how would he go about that in your class? Like, we know how it's done in, like, the upper class, but, like, how would he do that? And Jane is like, I don't know. it's just, like, a mystery. So that's something I consider, too, about, like, the class system would have been a big factor in how people talk to one another.
Right.
And what they noticed. Mm-hmm. As well. So that was fun to research.
What's interesting about Jane's voice, well, not just her voice, but even, like, the way other people talk about her throughout, is, like, she is really likable. Like, I mean, of course, again, like you said, she's obviously a monster, but yeah, there are times in this where I'm like, I love this Jane. Like, she's funny. She's, like, kind of a smart ass. She doesn't, in her own way, she doesn't take any shit, even though she has to take all this shit from people. Mm-hmm. It was just, like, she was likable. And then, of course, then things take a major turn for her. But I'm like, should I like her? Like, you know what I mean? It feels like,
yay,
it feels wrong, but...
Yeah, that's what I was going for.
Okay, well, thank you so much for
saying that, yeah. Susan.
It worked.
That's, yeah, it is conflicting. I mean, that's how I felt about her too, because she's a real chameleon. Mm-hmm. You know, like, she can turn it on. Yeah. And it was fun to write from her perspective before she was a monster and after she was a monster. She's very two-faced. Like, I feel about her the way I felt about Zac Efron's portrayal of Ted Bundy, where it was like, I'm not seeing you do these terrible things, but I'm pretty sure you're doing them. You know?
Like, yeah.
It's hard to reconcile, like, someone being so charismatic and so terrible, but yeah. But I'm glad that you, I mean, I'm paraphrasing what you said, but I'm glad that you think that Jane has big dick energy. That's what I was going for.
She definitely does. for sure. And then she gets a little too much of it, but
yeah,
a little too big for her bloomers at the end. But yeah, I mean, like, there's so many points where I think you feel, as a reader, you feel sympathy for her. And I mean, like, even as a child, when you're reading about what's happening to her, you do know where this is going. So it is this type of, it's like a conflicted sympathy where it's like, well, this is clearly leading somewhere horrible. Like, the title so tells me that. So. But, oh my gosh, I feel bad for her. And like, and I don't want to, you know, spoil any like major plot points for readers, but there's a part that's, you know, like a little heartbreak for her that I'm like, oh no. And also like, fuck that guy. Like, I'm so mad. And I remember thinking, I was like, oh, this is where it starts, obviously. Like, she's got to, this is who she's killing.
That was the last straw.
Well, like, one, I guess we'll just have like a kind of a final question, but what do you want people to take away from reading this, or what do you hope that they experience reading about Jane?
So, kind of your reaction is the goal. Like, yay. The way you're like, well, I like her, but I don't like that about her.
Yeah.
And I think that, I mean, the point of me writing it, I think, is one of my publisher, like, my publisher asked me that. She's like, what's the point of this? It's like, oh, well, I know that you didn't ask me that, but the takeaway, like, sort of the so what is the most important part of nonfiction. And I think the main, like, takeaway from this is that, I mean, hopefully it helps us consider how these things are allowed to happen and how we can stop that from happening, or at least stop people from wanting to do those things. And it's interesting too that you said that plot point that is a spoiler, so I'm not going to say it, but if y'all read this, which you should, buy my book, if you read it, you were like, oh, that's when it went off the rails. I felt like at any point in her life could have been like, oh, that's when. And I think pinpointing that, I don't want to say it's like a fun practice for us, but in fiction, it's fun, right? It's like, that's when I would have bailed out. That's when I would have known it's a cult. Or,
right,
you know,
yeah.
And so I think that putting this in, like, it's not really a whodunit because you know whodunit the whole time, but kind of trying to look at it and be like, well, if that person had been nice to her, this might not have happened. And I don't know what the answer is, but I think it's an important question to ask. And eventually someone will be like, this is the right answer. So I think that's the takeaway, is just like the question and having that gray area of like many things can be true, and just as a whole, like paying attention to terrible things. Was that an answer at all?
Absolutely. I was about to say, well said, because I thought it was well said.
I feel like it was real tangled up in my head. I was like, I'm...
All right. Well, let's tell people where they can get your book now.
Yeah. So the book is called America's First Female Serial Killer. It's published by Mango. It releases on May 19th. I can give you the link to the publisher's website if you want to include it in the show notes. You can also pre-order it on Amazon, IndieBound, Barnes & Noble, and if you like or prefer your independent bookstores, pretty much the way that it works, in my experience, is you go in and you say, hey, are y'all carrying this book? And they're like, we will. That's usually how it goes, because they want to sell you what you want to buy.
Yeah.
So if you want to patronize your local bookstore, you can go in and tell them that as well. But, you know, as the author, any way you buy it makes me happy. So if you're buying it – oh, and it's coming out on audiobook as well. I don't know what platforms yet, but I should know soonish because it's a little bit different.
Okay, awesome. Well, I can update that in the show notes when we know it, but – I feel like it would be fun to listen to also. So
I hope that you like it. I hope I did it justice. I tried real hard. So we'll see.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
Listeners, go out and buy.
This was super fun.
Go out and buy this book, everyone. America's First Female Serial Killer. Mary Kay, we love you.
Thank you.
We hope to have you back on soon.
I would love that so much. I have so much fun with y'all.
Yay.
Thank you.
All right. And once you've read her book, please send us some feedback and we'll read it. And maybe she can answer questions if you have them.
Oh,
and
I would love that. Yes.
Yeah. So send us questions, send us feedback. We would both love to hear it.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mary Kay.
You're the best. Thank you, Susan. All right. You're the best. Book Squad goals. Woo!
That was great, Susan.
That was great.
Thanks. It was so much fun to talk to her.
We love Mary Kay. Yay. She's been on the podcast several times.
You may and probably her. Will be again.
I'm sure.
Okay. Well, thank you to Mary Kay for joining us for that.
Thanks, Mary Kay.
Yeah.
And now, time for listener feedback about our last other episode about devs.
Yay, yay.
The mind-bending series that I watched all in one day, much like the documentary we just talked about.
Oh, no.
I have a bad habit developing during quarantine.
I definitely had to spread this one out.
Yeah, same.
For sure.
I just went for it. I mean, I didn't feel great afterwards. But I'm telling, it's quarantine. It's like, I'll be really productive for a while, and then I'll have a day where I'm like, I'm just going to start this, and then I can't stop.
Yeah.
So, anyway, back to devs. Who wants to read that?
I'll read it.
Yeah. Great.
This is from Seth from Hugo's, their podcast. Oh, which, Hugo's.
Oh, yeah.
What a good name.
Yeah. We should just quick shout out to the Hugo's, their podcast. If you like sci-fi books, definitely check it out. Seth's goal is to read through all the Hugo Award-winning sci-fi
books.
Noble
goal.
Oh, awesome.
So, pretty cool. Check that out. And thanks for writing in with this feedback.
Seth says, my main thought is that when I saw Sergey's reaction to seeing the code was that the central twist of the show would be that they discovered the universe was simulated. I still feel like it's a theory that could be defended, though you'd have to acknowledge, I think, that it was just one of many simulations. I'm so dead set against determinism, either scientific or religious, that I'm glad the show went another direction, acknowledging free will. Agreed.
Yeah.
I think that's interesting. We didn't really talk about the universe, the whole universe being simulated as maybe a way to look at.
Yeah.
I guess that kind of fits with the ending, because in the ending we know that they're in a simulation of sorts, but also, what is in a simulation?
Right. I mean, I guess it's weird that, like, if this world that the world that we were originally watching was a simulation, it's weird that they would, like, figure out how to create a simulation within a simulation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that would be my only, like, argument against it, would be that, like, if they hadn't figured it out yet, then how could it exist?
Because they had figured it out, and then they figured it out again.
I can't.
I feel like my mind has already been blown enough that I don't know if I can even handle putting in another theory of what happened.
Yeah. And this is why there won't be a second season.
Yeah.
Thank goodness.
But we'll watch the next Alex Garland joint, whatever that is.
Yes. We loved this. We just are glad that it stopped when it was supposed to.
Waiting for him to announce his next project. Let us know, Alex.
The next one.
Okay, Mary.
This is from Justin.
Oh, who's
from
he?
From Birmingham.
Who?
Oh, he lives in Birmingham. Susan, that's where you live.
That's so crazy.
Oh,
do you
wait.
Know him?
Do you think? Do we live
Could
together?
Be.
I live with that guy. We're do the only him? Two humans the other one has seen.
Is that that
yes,
guy that you
and
married?
You might remember Justin from our episode about Dr. Sleep.
And from being married to Susan.
And from being married to Susan.
He too
says,
watched this in one sitting with me.
Nice. Justin says, I liked this series. First of all, how can you go wrong with Nick Offerman? One of the best. I agree.
That's true.
I really like seeing him in a more serious role. I think the plot and the storyline came together just the way you'd want a sci-fi thriller to come together. All that to say, I wasn't disappointed. With all the content out these days, it's easy to have a good idea and let it flop. I'm more of a futuristic sci-fi fan, and this delivered in a way that's not out of the realm of possibilities. All the characters come together really well. It almost reminded me of a Black Mirror episode. Would absolutely recommend this to anyone. I feel it should also be noted that I watched this entire thing in one sitting. LOL.
Yes. Oh, I guess I didn't need to tell you that because he was going to do it.
Spoiler, he also watched it.
Yeah. He sent me so this like crazy. Right before. So
yeah. Totally agree about Nick Offerman being in a more serious role because I feel like yes. we don't get that often and it's nice to see. And he did a
I've
really
never
good job.
Seen it and it surprised me in a good way.
He yeah. is a very good actor. I mean, I think comedy is pretty hard anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think often comedic actors end up being skilled, like, dramatic actors.
For sure. And it does remind me of a Black Mirror episode.
But, like, a good
sort
one.
Sort of extended out.
Yeah. I have recommended this to, like, so many people. Yeah. And also, like, a lot of friends that have watched it. Like, everyone I know who's watched it has loved it. So, if you haven't checked it out yet, definitely, definitely watch Devs. It's on Hulu. All yeah. of it is streaming now. It's only 8 episodes. And then listen to our episode. And if you want to write us some feedback about it later, we'll still read it. Because we're like that.
We sure will.
Yeah.
What's on the pod?
Well, I've been rewatching The Tudors. Not for the first, this isn't my first rewatch, but it is my first rewatch while being totally isolated from the rest of the world. So,
and not the last.
It's probably not. Once I get out of the house, I'll watch it again and see if I find new things.
You
anyway,
should.
I wrote
you should,
about that experience during
You should
quarantine.
Write about it again because now I'm rewatching it.
Look, I will write about it again. I'm just now, I always have to take a little break after Ambulance.
I just thought of the best blog idea for The Tudors. We should rate the top 10 sex scenes.
Okay.
In The Tudors.
Into it.
Two of them just popped in my head, so.
Yeah, same here. I wonder if any of them are the same, but we're going to wait and show you that later. Speaking of television shows, there's a lot of TV on the blog right now. We just don't have very much else to do. So we've been watching a lot of television. Janet and I both watched Little Fires Everywhere. We had one blog post about it, but we weren't done. On the second blog post, we focused more on the 90s setting and the pop culture references, which were super cool. And we get a little personal about which one spoke to us because, you know, we were both alive in the 90s. Yeah. Susan. You've got another one here. We kind of went back and forth for some reason.
Yeah. Cool. I also, speaking of more documentaries, I've been watching a lot of them lately, but I watched this new one called The House in Between about a haunted house in Mississippi. It's cooler than that description just sounded like, though. So
I want to watch it now.
That sounds really cool to me, so I'm watching it.
Yeah, it's good. It's been like a 10-year investigation of this house, so there's a lot of footage of it and interesting evidence. And it's only like 80 minutes long, so it's
a tight 80.
It's a tight 81 minutes.
Speaking of television, Ben and I are watching Tales from the Loop. And Mary, I think you're watching it too, aren't you?
I haven't started it yet. I want to finish The Great first.
Oh gosh, I finished that so fast. So good. Okay, real fast aside, The Great is like so good I can't even write about it because I just like gush about how much I love it. So I'm going to write about Tales from the Loop instead because I feel like I have some critiques and some thoughts. It's a really great show overall. It's very depressing for me. I don't know, like, just puts me in a really bad mood after I finish every episode. But,
love it.
Sounds great.
I keep watching anyway, but I'm going to rank the episodes of Tales from the Loop because they're all little linked stories. And, yeah, that's on Amazon if you want to check it out and cry.
Also, it's time for YA Book Club!
Yeah!
The this month we're reading The Kingdom of Back by Marie Lu. You might remember we talked about Marie Lu's novel War Cross in a previous YA book club. She's got a new novel out, and we are...
This is nothing like War Cross.
It's nothing like War Cross. This is more of a fantasy novel, and it's also about Mozart and his sisters.
So down.
There's a lot going on in this novel. I'm almost done with it.
Well, we will be talking about it soon, and it will probably be up by the time this episode is out. I need to check the calendar. If not, it'll be up...
Very soon.
Within seconds.
You know what is up?
Listen to your heart. The finale.
The final episode.
The final ep. Who will win?
Mary, who will win? If you watched, you know. If not, don't watch. Just read our recap.
Yeah, it's I didn't watch, but I feel like I did. Because I read all the recaps. And I
there was a moment earlier this week when Ty was like, what if we listen to the winner's new album? And I was like, no.
I've been meaning to. I just feel like it's going to be very Christian.
I think it's going to be, like, a lot of soft, boring ballads.
Yeah. But, I mean, maybe, what if it's great?
Yeah.
You never know.
It could be.
You never know. I also have written something for the blog.
Oh, have you?
Yep.
Cool.
And it's a secret.
Check it out. If that appeals to you, you can visit
booksawgoals.com. Even to myself at the time of this recording.
On our next episode, we are reading Mostly Dead Things by Kristen Arnett. This episode will be coming out June 15th. This is my pick. It is about Florida. It is about taxidermy. It is about lesbians or queer people. I haven't read it yet.
As is tradition, you know, we don't know what we're talking about.
Definitely read it and then listen to our episode when it comes out in 2 weeks. What's our next other sode, Emily?
Oh, yes, it's me. Okay, so we literally decided this earlier today, so... but there is, you know, there aren't a lot of movies coming out right now, but this is actually one we're pretty excited about. It's a movie called Shirley. It's not about, I'm trying
Shirley
to think
Temple.
Of
Shirley Temple. Shirley's.
Yeah, it's not about Shirley Temple. Thank you.
I would watch that though. I love Shirley Temple.
Yeah, Shirley MacLaine.
I would absolutely watch that. I was, I was obsessed with Shirley Temple as a little girl. Like, loved those
I
movies.
Have the, anyway. I have the whole Shirley Temple collection if you want to write about that one day.
Oh my God, we should. Anyway, but no, this is about Shirley Jackson, and we have talked about Shirley Jackson on the podcast before, so this seemed very on brand. We even had a conversation with Grady Hendrix recently about how more people need to read Shirley Jackson. So we're going to talk about this movie. It's starring Elizabeth Moss, who we also like, I think, generally speaking. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm excited to talk about it. And yeah,
yay.
Maybe I'll read some more Shirley Jackson before then. But you know what? I get a little ambitious with my reading.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens.
No promises. If you have any comments, questions, or general feedback about this or any other episode that we have ever recorded, you can email it to the squad at booksquadcoals.com.
Nope.
Our website is booksquadgoals.com. You can go there to check out our blog or see our other podcasts. But, you know, a better way to see our podcast would be to go to your podcast app of choice, which is probably what you're listening to us on right now. You should subscribe. We really would love that. We would love to have more subscribers. We would also love it if you left us a rating and review. The best place to do that would be on Apple Podcasts, which I know you don't want to do. I know that it's annoying.
Sometimes and I know gotta.
That it's like, it feels like a whole thing, but it's actually really fast to do it. And we would be so grateful to you. So grateful. So please do that. Follow us on social media. We are at Book Squad Goals on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Yeah. We haven't solicited pictures of pets with books for a while, but we're always down for those. So
yes. Yeah, just know there's an open invitation.
Hashtag that request never expires.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, this has been, would I say fun? I don't know.
Enlightening.
I'm really glad I got to talk about it with somebody and that I didn't have to just watch it and sit with it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So thank you for talking about this with me.
Always.